For exclusive podcasts and more, sign up at patreon.com/partnersincrimemedia.
This week's Law & Order Marathon winner is Jonathan Calloway of Ringgold, Georgia. Jonathan will get a marathon decal showing he watched 26.2 hours of his favorite crime show. To be next week's winner, sign up at lawandorderpodcast.com.
I'm Kevin Flynn with Rebecca Lavoy and Jawan Holmes, and these are their stories.
You think you know who did it, but you don't know who did it. Law and order, law and order, law and order. It's no ordinary police procedural, baby. It's the FNOG of police procedures, baby. Law and order, law and order, law and order, law and order. These are their stories, these are their stories.
Welcome to These Are the Stories, the podcast about network TV's most enduring crime franchise and the real-life cases that inspire their shows. I'm Kevin Flynn. Each podcast will break down an episode from either Criminal Intent, SVU, or Original Recipe. And today, we're looking at the series finale of Criminal Intent, Season 10, Episode 8, To the Boy in the Blue Knit Cap.
I beg your pardon. Twin number one killed twin number two.
We think?
Not so much for brotherly love.
Joining me to do just that is true crime author and the host of Crime Writers On and Netflix's You Can't Make This Up podcasts, Rebecca Lavoy. Hello, Rebecca.
I don't want your laugh, Kevin.
Oh, could that possibly be a reference to somebody in our in this episode?
It could be.
It could be. All right, Pacey. Joining us.
You mean Dawson.
Well, he's got to have a partner, Joey. Rounding out our panel is our special guest from the LGBTQ Nation website, it's Jawan Holmes. Hi, Jawan.
Hi, Rebecca. Thank you, Kevin. Hi. I'm glad to be on and talk about Law & Order, which I know very well from growing up and living in my early days in my early internet days of Tumblr. So I'm excited to get it going.
Tumblr.
I was going to say, yeah, you have this cool old school Tumblr, like with GIFs and everything like that. And I mean, it's no Kismate. We'll get into that. But how did you get into that? How did you get into Law and Order in general?
So, yeah, I've always I think the first time I watched a Law and Order episode, I had to be 9 or 10, which is the perfect age to watch something as kid appropriate as Law and Order. And so I've just always been in love with it. And I used to watch it I would watch them as they aired. So I remember like even watching SVU season 10. My mom was always super into that one. As I got on my early days of the internet, the Law and Order was, everyone had a show, you know, really the big show on Tumblr was always Supernatural.
I love me some Sam and Dean anyway, but,
yeah,
but I digress.
Huge Supernatural fan here, yeah. By the way. Okay. You just touched his heart.
So I created a blog called In the Law and Order Universe, which was dedicated to the entire series, the entire franchise. And so I would just share anything I came across. I had to be 13 or I had to be 14 or 15 when I started this blog. But
wow.
How pissed are you that you didn't come up with this podcast before we did?
I would have. I am a little bit upset about it, but I would have if I wasn't preoccupied with high school and surviving and living and doing those things you do in the teen years.
Of all the franchises, which two cops are your favorite detective team?
Favorite Law and Order detective team.
So my favorite detective team, I thought very long about this question, the one that's going to come next, but I really think I have to say Gorin and Eames.
Oh,
yeah,
and
okay.
And I guess my close second, very close second, even though they don't get a lot of storylines of airtime focused on them, was Munch and Finn.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, but I loved that Gorin and Eames always had each other's back, no matter what. And it wasn't like, you know, even the Elliot, Olivia will just follow. And it wasn't, obviously it had toxicity and very convoluted connection there. But it wasn't as weird as the Elliot and Olivia one grew over the... I guess it was weird, but it felt different than the Elliot and Olivia connection. I appreciate how they worked with each other. And I also appreciate... I really think Eames is a very underrated detective. She's very good at this job.
Agreed.
So...
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yep.
And she's very good at managing her nutty partner.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So.
Hey, Juwan, who's your favorite prosecutorial team?
Favorite Law and Order District Attorney prosecutorial team.
If I had to choose a team, I would have to say Cutter and Ruberosa.
Wow.
Yeah.
I like their dynamic as a team. And again, if we're talking about teams, because my favorite DA altogether is Novak, as messy as she is.
I have one question, though. Serena Sutherland, lesbian or not a lesbian? Settle it.
Is this because I'm a lesbian?
To be honest, I didn't know this was an unsettled question. I thought it was...
No one really believes it. They think it was a bullshit line at the end to give her a splashy exit.
Yeah.
Because there was no indication. Even when you watch previous episodes, it's not signaled in any way. Not that it should be, because, you know, a lesbian can just come to work and be a professional person, but like, it's almost the opposite of being signaled. like it was definitely an idea that just came from somewhere.
I think that's what made it interesting, in that, as we see with the spinoffs, they are obviously more reliant and they need to have the storylines focus on the characters more. But with the original, especially... It did that in the beginning, but as it got towards the 2000s, it very much kept away from getting personal with anyone that wasn't Jack, and that wasn't even Lenny, really, even, and barely even Lenny, for, you know, the fact that he was there 12 years. And I think she's bisexual. I think she's
there
a very
you go.
Much.
That solves the mystery.
Solves everything.
I think it's canon to call her bisexual.
There you go. All right, now let's take a look at the first half of this episode, Criminal Intent, Season 10, Episode 8, To the Boy in the Blue Knit Cap.
Ugh.
It's a stupid name, right?
He never takes off that fucking
hat. Okay, we'll get to that now, all right? Boy, it's not bottle service that Rex and Danielle get in the club. It's an unwelcome visit from rich prep boy and bag de douche, Parker Gaffney. He and his twin brother Thomas are suing Danielle because she made millions stealing their idea for a social networking site. She is the face of Kismate, along with her hipster slacker millennial fuckface boyfriend PJ. One night, the janitor comes to clean the Kismate offices and finds one dead body on the floor, and then one more that looks exactly like the first one.
The blood trail leads over here. So Thomas's body was dragged from the area that he was killed.
Levers bent, and it's consistent to the wound on Thomas's head.
He was pushed into the pinball machine, maybe during a struggle.
Right, the killer might have been dragging Thomas's body away when Parker showed up.
So why were the twins killed in the offices of their business rival? Their business partner, Samir, tells Gorn and Eames that Parker was the hothead and Thomas left on emergency business earlier in the evening. There's palpable tension between Danielle and PJ, who both deny killing their rivals. The detectives find Rex, their hard-partying business partner and former pornographer who swears the lawsuit that could have just ruined him weren't nothing. Gorin suspects deodorant on Parker's hands meant that he tried to move Thomas's sweaty body by grabbing him by the sweaty armpits. But if that's the case, then who killed Parker with the scissors? Samir provides the detectives a copy of the MacGuffin algorithm that shows the Gaffneys had a strong case against Danielle, that she perhaps stole their technology, and the supposedly stolen swipe card of sexy but disgruntled assistant Hildy was used to get into the office right after the security cameras were shut off. Gorn and Eames accuse Danielle of knowing Parker was on his way to find that algorithm, and that's when Samir says no, he was with Danielle all night. Okay, so we get the usual Criminal Intent setup, quick vignettes of all the characters, each with some problem and something to hide and arguing, so we get suspicious of all of them. This includes the rich father talking about the lawsuit with one of the twins while fencing the other.
You're going to let these people screw you while you smile and say thank you? Not my son. Man up, boy. Fight or die.
And so Law and Order Criminal Intent said, hey, We're not spending a dime on some green screen to do this twin actor bullshit. You go here, stand on the left, then go change your clothes and come back. Fuck that. We're going to make your twin brother wear a fencing mask.
Yes.
And just pretend that's him underneath there.
Listen, this was the most discount Social Network situation I have ever seen. Everything about this episode is discount, which I actually really love. And the fencing mask part, the best.
I was going to, you know, going from the very beginning, that opening scene where, or the opening part where they, the janitor discovers the body and looks at them for like 5 minutes before he decides to run away. It's probably, that's probably one of like the funniest part. It was like, is
they might get up.
It's one of those small things where it's like, are they going to turn this into something that matters later? Because I was like, is he going to actually report it or is he just going to run away? And because, I mean, like, he's looking at them and, like, the beginning just gave a very classic criminal intent on every level.
So before he faces his son in combat and go after him with an sword?
Epee.
Oh, epee's like an epipen. An epee. Yeah, right. So Mr. Gaffney, before he does that, takes a big swig of scotch. Man, they won't let you drink beer bowling anymore.
Mr. Gaffney is the most toxic masculinity mascot I have ever seen in my entire life on television. He tells his son to, quote, man up.
Man up, boy.
He's literally waving swords at his children.
For fun.
Yeah.
He is just like...
And he commissioned a really creepy oil painting of the twins.
Oh, my God. That painting, to me, was the best detail in this entire episode. Because if you have twins... and they look exactly alike. Why do you need a painting of both of them? like the whole thing about a portrait is it's like, this is me, right? Why? Why do you need one that portrays both of them?
You just look at one, you know, it looks like the other.
Is it to show that one enjoys chambray and the other one enjoys a different kind of shirt? I don't know.
God.
I don't get it at all.
So the Kismet website is like Craigslist misconnections, right?
Okay.
It's just not as sad as that, however. So the title of this episode is To the Boy in the Blue Knit Cap, and that's because that's the message that Danielle sent to PJ to start their romance, and the entire website and company is built on that catchphrase. So when Goren sees PJ come to the office, he says,
you have a cap. You're the guy in the posters.
Yeah, you're a fucking genius detective, apparently. And then he says to him, so do you work here?
You work here?
Nobody actually works there. Mm. He's there playing pool.
Pinball.
Right, everybody's like, hey, when are you going to clean up this blood? Because I want to go play foosball.
Right. Can we just talk about...
I got a rock climbing wall I got to get to. I mean, it's the most millennial fucking episode in the world.
How bad does PJ's hat smell at this point?
He just wears that hat.
He wears it all the time. It's gross. It looks like a well tip on the end of a condom. That's just my opinion.
The office is not even... It's funny how they did this episode. They were just like, do we really need... to, you know, in the old criminal intent episodes, they would have given like a whole office building on... 40, a whole exterior shot, the whole 10 floors. They were like, let's just give the corner where the guy who never is in the office has an office, this the pinball machines, and then the pool table in the middle.
Nothing says romance like a pinball machine with two people's faces on it.
Listen, they had to buy a sticker to put that name on that pinball machine.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
And then we're going to put Hildy's desk in the front, and that's the whole office. That's really all you ever see after the first part. And so that was the part I was always just like, are we ever going to see more of, like, I don't know if we ever see where Danielle, I think we see where she sits.
Nope.
But it's just like,
it's right next to the air hockey table.
And it's like, do five people work here and do they just cram into this?
I just made that point. Nobody actually works there.
It's just like SVU, where there's like three people on the squad and 18 people in the background doing nothing.
Yes, exactly. But they didn't even give the background. They just gave the wall.
So even in the very last episode of Criminal Intent, Goren cannot stop telling Rogers how to do her fucking job.
Yes.
So the murder clue was that Thomas's armpits were drenched in sweat, apparently from dancing at that club. And we know that Parker moved the body because there was antiperspirant on his hands. Well, judging by the amount of pit sweat, he obviously wasn't wearing any antiperspirant.
I mean, the what was the tell for Goran was watching JVB go out on the dance floor and like raise the roof in his suit jacket. Which, yeah. By the way, you don't fucking do that. Listen, I'm not exactly a person who goes to clubs regularly, but when I do not wear a woolen suit jacket onto the dance floor.
What do you say about that, Juwan?
When Goran sits next to him in that booth and like squeezes,
it's in his personal space.
It is like they just love doing the weirdest things. And I was like, so how did you find the antiperspirant and all of this days after through an autopsy when you're going through the body? You know, so that was a little. It wasn't a plot hole because it sort of makes sense, but it was just, you know, like, oh yeah, we found this days later, this evidence that their hands were on each other. Even though they're twins, so they share DNA.
Yes, it could have been his. You know, it literally could have been his own underarm sweat. There's no. He could have been like Mary Catherine Gallagher.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Before he showed
exactly.
up at that office.
Well, it's funny when they get to that club. The first thing that happens is that Goran Eames want to get beyond this velvet rope to go talk to Rex.
Sorry, VIPs only.
She pulls out her badge and says,
"We're on the list.
We're on the list." And the big bouncer says,
"Yes, you are.
Yes, you are." And he's like, "Fine, you can please go ahead and not bother me anymore." So Rex, the pornographer, right, is former pornographer. Sorry,
former interactive
virtual eroticism. Yeah, right, whatever. He's surrounded by like all these champagne room models, and he's like, "No, go away, ladies." And then turns to Eames and is like,
"Now, if you don't mind, I'm gonna hit the dance floor. Care to join?"
Pass.
You're lost.
I totally am now infatuated with Eames / Catherine Irby.
Yeah.
She just comes off as really warm and not like a detective at all, really, you know, in the best possible way. But still, I don't know if I would, you know, when you've got like swimsuit models all over, you know.
Okay, so let's just talk about Eames for a second.
All right, sure.
She has a weird and childlike beauty. I find her to be incredibly beautiful, but she also looks like a Hummel. You know what a Hummel is? Like one of those figurines with a giant eyes. And like,
you want her to be your big sister.
I want her to be my big sister.
Exactly.
I want her to be my mom. I want her to be my best friend. I want her to be my work wife. I want her to be all of those things.
Yeah.
I want her to move in. Like, I want her to be near me all the time. The one thing I don't want to do is grind on her on the dance floor.
Yeah.
The one thing I don't want to do.
But it was very just like, is every criminal they gonna interact with be attractive to her or try to use her attractiveness for something?
But meanwhile, only Cutter is attracted to Ruberosa, who is like objectively the most beautiful woman who's ever been on the planet Earth. Ever. Only he sees it somehow.
Oh my God. The only thing that can make that better is that if Ruberosa said, "I'm a lesbian and I have film." You know, but if Rex started to, you know, grind up on Eames on the dance floor, that is another way to get his DNA. All right, let's take a look at our cast.
It's our very special guest star,
Mr. James Vanderbeek.
He's
playing slimy internet porn hipster Rex Tamlin.
You guys can bitch at each other all you want, but let's not forget why we're here in the first place, huh? Kismet, baby! People believe in it, so you better keep living it.
First of two Law & Order appearances, you know him best as playing James Vanderbeek in Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23.
Yep.
And playing James Vanderbeek in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. And that's it.
That's it. We don't know him from anything else. We don't know from Dawson's Creek. We don't know him from that football movie. Nothing else. Just those things.
No, I'm not too familiar with that one. But I do know James Vanderbeek from those two things. Literally just those two things and Ugly Betty. That was probably the first thing I saw him in. I think he did a few episodes in that one.
Mom was a dancer. Dad was a minor league baseball player. Mm. James transitioned to acting when he got a concussion playing football.
Ooh.
Which is why Joey picked Pacey.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's just talk about it. Joshua Jackson was the real star of Dawson's Creek.
He was. We have a Hey, It's That Girl.
Hey, it's that girl.
Can you tell us who's playing Dr. Paula Geisen, Goran's therapist?
The job gives you structure, sense of purpose. But you're convinced that it's the only thing that defines you.
That's very fancy actress Julia Ormond.
Oh,
yes, Emmy Award winner Julia Ormond, best known as Sabrina from the movie Sabrina, as well as Legends of the Fall. Her last few big roles include Don Draper's Canadian mother-in-law on Mad Men, who had an affair with Roger Sterling.
That's right.
And also, she's now the lead in The Walking Dead, World Beyond, which Rebecca 1,000,000% will not be watching.
Nope. I hate zombies.
She's a UN Goodwill ambassador for her efforts to stop sex trafficking. And she no longer wants to live the life of a beach-bathing former ingenue. Last month, she told The Telegraph, I'm over suntans. She just wants to go glamping.
Love her.
I'm glad that suntans are still on the table for her. After all these years, I admire that.
We also have a cameo by defense attorney Danielle Melnick in the beginning. Who is that?
Then I need more than your word against hers. I need evidence to put this over the top. You bring me a smoking gun.
So yeah, Danielle Melnick was the defense attorney from the original Law and Order.
Yes.
And so that, like I said, that was the nice touch of giving this connection, you know, to the original. And, you know, she's the reason all this, she's sort of the reason this all happens, because she's like, get me a smoking gun, which she almost never had as a defense attorney, but she was still won anyway. But she was like, find me a smoking gun and I'll do it. And they're like, okay, let's murder some people.
That's Tova Felsha. Two Emmy nominations, one for the TV miniseries Holocaust, co-starring Michael Moriarty as a Nazi who's not totally down with the Holocaust.
I don't know if I believe that he's not down with the Holocaust.
Hey, I guess there are fine people on both sides.
Oh,
to
God,
quote
Michael
somebody.
Moriarty.
And I'm sure he did all of his scenes in Holocaust looking at a pie plate. Tova was also nominated for playing this character, Danielle Melnick, in season one of Law and Order in 1990. So, as you say, Juwan, nice bookend there. How about website developer Danielle McGee? Who's that actress?
We're not a hookup service, and we're not Facebook. We're a networking site dedicated to romantic connectivity, to kismet.
That's Natalie Gold. She's on Rebecca's favorite show, Succession, as Kendall Roy's estranged ex-wife.
Really?
Yes, that's the ex-wife there.
Wow.
Or, I don't know if they're ex or whatever, but she's also in The Walking Dead, World Beyond. Again, a show that 1,000,000% Rebecca will never watch. We have a Hey, It's That Guy.
Hey, it's that guy.
Can you tell me, the actor playing Samar, the business partner?
6 months later, she launched Kismate, our idea.
I didn't know him before this episode, but Manish Dayal, he's also one of the lead in The Resident, as you said, on Fox. And so I've seen him in that, and I saw him in something else that I can't remember, but I didn't realize before rewatching this how good he looked. And I'm not one of those people that normally gawks at the... I'm not one of those people that typically gawks at the guy. But I was like, does no one notice how beautiful he is?
Yeah, he's on, you say he's on The Resident. He is acting in that show alongside Malcolm Jamal Warner, whose Cosby Show residuals dropped to $0 for some reason.
For some reason.
He had to get a job? Well, that's tough. Can you tell me the name of the actor playing the crime scene detective at the beginning?
I got two bodies. Janitor found them this morning. The victims are Parker and Thomas Gaffney.
Our good old veteran, hey, it's that guy, Isaiah Whitlock Jr. of
yes.
The Law and Order. He's probably done... I have to imagine he's done at least 30 episodes between.
He's
all
done
three.
14 Law and Order episodes. He's probably most recognized for his supporting role in The Wire as State Senator Clay Davis, whose catchphrase is, Rebecca?
Oh, shit.
The different ways he says, she.
But he also follows me on Twitter, which
he
is my favorite thing about him.
Oh, wow. Recently, he's been in Showtime's Your Honor. He just appeared in Spike Lee's Oscar-nominated movie, The Five Bloods. Do you recognize the actor playing the twins' father? No?
You're just teasing me.
I'm teasing you.
If you let this girl play you for a fool, you'll be sucking hind teeth for the rest of your life. That's not the Gaffney way.
That actor's name is Richard Beckins. We just saw him in the last episode of this podcast playing Councilman Richard Durbin's, the gay politician murdered by a homophobic politician.
That was the same guy?
It was the same guy.
Does not look like the same guy.
Well, it's, you know, like 15 years later or something. And ironically, it's that punch that's the whole reason that Logan's on criminal intent in the first place.
So the guy who played a gay politician killed by a homophobic person.
Yeah.
Then in a later episode, played a guy telling his sons in a very toxic masculine way to, quote, man up.
Yeah, he has range. Okay. And who is playing Parker and Thomas Gaffney, the twins?
Enjoy yourselves while you can, because the fun train is over.
I gotta take this one.
Okay, Rebecca, who is that?
That is Thad Luckinbill, who played J.T. Hellstrom, Victoria Newman's formerly nice but later abusive husband on The Young and the Restless, who, by the way, a group of women clubbed on the head and then buried, but he was actually alive, and he came back and attacked them again.
The fuck?
It was a whole thing. And I also know him, by the way, as Discount Ryan Quantin, because he looks just like Ryan Quantin from True Blood, except Discount with a not as good body.
Yeah, you got that right.
I'm Young and the Restless.
Fat Luckin' Bill. Crazy thing, though, he actually has an identical twin brother.
Shut the fuck up.
No, Trent Luckin' Bill. Trent Luckin' Bill played dead sweaty Thomas Gaffney.
Shut the fuck up!
Right? You didn't see him in the shot when the two of them should be standing together.
Shut the fuck up!
But the thing where they panned here, and they just as easily could have panned there. They didn't need him for that.
Should they both sit for the painting? That's my
Oh my goodness. So two things. One is, did you not know that, Rebecca, in all the other information you knew about him, was that a complete surprise to you?
And all that you didn't know.
100% surprise. I'm a Young and the Restless fan. I know him as JT. I did not know he had a twin.
Wow. And then the other thing is, I love that twins in Hollywood almost never work together. Like, after they have to as kids, probably.
Yeah.
Like, when was the last time you saw Cole and Dylan Sprouse in the same thing?
All right, now let's take a look at the second half of this episode. When he said that he was with Danielle, Samir says, not in a sexual way that would make for a good commercial break cliffhanger.
Mm.
He said that he and Danielle were working on a settlement.
The twins and I would receive 15% of preferred stock and a percentage of royalties based on sales.
All right, which at the current valuation of the company comes...
$37 million. A drop in the bucket for Danielle.
But worth it to her to avoid the bad publicity of a lawsuit.
In business, sometimes you win by surrendering.
The Gaffneys didn't know Samir was trying to settle the case. He says Parker was out for blood, but Thomas really didn't have his heart in the legal battle. Gorn and Eames confront coked-up Dawson that maybe he shut off the video cameras while he was waiting for Parker to break into the Kismet office, and he says, I don't want to wait for my life to be over. I want to know right now. Will
Juwan
it be?
Will not get that reference as a non-Dawson's Creek fan.
He set up a hidden camera to snap a pic of whomever shuts off the security system, but the lens was blocked by, of all things, a blue knit cap.
Mm.
Loverboy PJ admits that he was smashing with Hildy because his corporate storyline romance with Danielle was on the rocks. And Parker got Hildy's swipe card by threatening to expose the fling and destroy the company. But how did Parker know about the affair? He learned it from his twin brother, Thomas. But how did Thomas know about the affair? Because he was having one with Danielle. After one final Gorn explication, for good measure, we learn that Thomas went to the Kismet office to stop Parker. When Danielle had discovered that Parker had smashed her lover's head on the pinball machine, she stabbed the other twin with the pair of scissors. Later, we see Gorn finishing up his mandatory therapy sessions with Dr. Geisen. She says that he has trust and anger issues and would benefit from more therapy, but will be able to keep his job as a New York City detective. Waiting from outside is Alex Eames, saying they just got a call. A contemplative Bobby Gorn, appreciative of his career and his longtime partner, ride off into the concrete cesspool of violence and depravity known as New York City. Okay.
Yes.
So earlier in this episode, Gorn is interrogating Samir, and he yells back at Gorn,
"Are you insane?"
And Gorn says,
"Jury's still out on that one."
Jury's still out on that one. No, it's not. Guilty as fucking charged. So PJ might be a dirty hippie slacker, but we do know that he takes off that fucking wool cap to get it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he also has this, I mean, I guess it's like in Flavor Flav, he must take off the clock around his neck, right? Even though that's his thing. He has this aside with PJ, Goran does, talking about like dating, being like foraging on the savannah.
I mean, that kind of possessiveness is not what assured us our survival when we were out there, you know, foraging on the savannah. Ah, la, 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 la.
Like a mad dog. What the hell was that?
Don't know. I don't know. All I know is that does not help him see us as less insane.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think that was one of the odd moments that didn't really fit in with the I was going to say, everything in this episode is pretty classic Criminal Intent, and that was like the, yeah, we're going to still make him seem crazy even at the end. So I was like, okay.
It feels like D'Onofrio was like, this is my last episode. This is the finale of the series. I am method. I only have a couple of scenes left to do that.
I want
to
actually eat the furniture.
So I'm going to do method right now in this scene. And I say the word Savannah, and whatever comes to me, I'm just going to do that thing. That's what it felt like to me.
That's pretty dangerous.
I really hope he doesn't listen to this episode. I really do.
Well, all this gets us back to the final scenes of the episode and thus the final episodes of the series. So after the assassination of Captain Ross and that whole storyline.
Spoiler alert.
There's so much fucking drama on this show. You remember Goran and Eames left. They had a fire, Goran, and Eames resigned. And that was season 8 or 9. And then they're gone. And they come back here at season 10 to kind of have one final hurrah of 8 episodes. And sort of the hook is that Goran has to go to therapy in order to find out whether he keep his job, and so he's working through his shit throughout the whole season. So it comes to this at the end. And so they have this psych evaluation. First of all, with the series ending, it really is possible that, you know, the writers could say, yeah, Goran, you are going to lose your job. Because it would be one way to end the whole thing.
Are you going to take my job away?
I'm going to tell them that you are more than capable of holding down your job. And that you have anger and trust issues that would benefit from further treatment.
Geisen says, you have trust issues, and to that end, you should probably see somebody else.
She can't wait to get rid of him.
That doesn't really help your trust issues, right? If your therapist says, let me make a referral.
And you should keep your badge, keep your badge and your gun, and go to someone else that isn't me.
That is who you want to have a gun, right? That is who you want to have a gun. And that's why we are where we are. Let's
be real. Yeah. Not just on this show. Thanks, America.
Yeah, exactly.
So the final scene of the series is that Goran steps outside. And first off, no shit. He's wearing a completely different outfit than when he left that office. Mm. I'm not joking. I know, Rebecca, I give you crap for like talking about stuff that you see.
Yeah.
He comes out with a blazer and a light blue sweater, and he had a dark blue. Never mind. Okay. I guess there's a locker room that he hit after that session.
Continuity.
Yeah, continuity. So he steps out, and his best friend, Eames, is there in support. Now, this scene mirrors a scene in season 6, episode 3, when Eames had to do her mandatory therapy. Similar looking brownstone, quiet side street. He surprises her by showing up in support. I'm going to play some of those clips back to back.
How'd it go?
Just 3 more sessions.
How'd it go?
Good.
Good.
Well, I can drop you off. Call. I got it.
A call came in. DOA hit a bank on West 44th Street. The feds are already on their way, but I thought we might want to get there first.
Well, then let's go.
Let's go.
And then they drive off like Batman and Robin onto the next adventure. Look, this is the only Law & Order franchise that got to pick its ending.
Uh-huh.
Because Original Recipe didn't know it was going off the air. SVU is still chugging along, of course. So the question is, how do you think they did wrapping it up?
First of all, the series really gave like 5 different endings. I mean, we have it was so many opportunities to just dismiss it. I mean, you got... Literally, the like we were talking about the season 9 intro, and they're like, yeah, we're just gonna continue. We're going to end this their saga and just send them off with Goran getting fired, Eames leaving her badge. And then, yeah, we're just going to go to Nichols and Stevens and let it keep going. And then screw them and not explain how they leave. And so it goes into this back and forth that just, you know, it's so weird. I guess it wanted to get away from focusing on Goran and Eames, but it's the entire series is just, they basically couldn't do it right. And so I love this episode. It's probably the strongest episode of the season other than Icarus,
which was the show right before this.
Yeah, with Cynthia Nixon.
Yes. Who was in the second episode of Original Recipe. Yes. So, yeah, again, kind of all coming around.
Yeah, but I love this episode. But the one thing I felt when watching it was that this should have not been the closer. If anything, it should have been the opening episode. I feel like it was so strong and it was so classic. This is how you would have wrote people back versus how you want to sort of dismiss it. And like in terms of the actual murder and the investigation part, because as you can tell, they probably just they were like, yeah, we're going to film these episodes and then we're going to put the therapist scenes in a different part.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like that's how they did it.
That was my feeling, too.
And look, you got to remember that at the end of the series, this wasn't even on NBC anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was on USA.
Yeah.
Where they would put it on Sunday night on USA and then the rerun was sometime on NBC. Yeah. But I got to say, I watched the Criminal Intent pilot right after watching this episode. And by the way, to bust a myth, you know, we see like in the opening credits, like the classic scene of like Goran like leaning over, like, what was happening, that was from the pilot in that episode. What he was actually doing there is he was trying to do the upside down reading of what the guy was writing.
Ah.
Wasn't doing like some super magic fucking thing. And it's like, oh, he's so smart. Look at that. He's looking at somebody upside down. He's a genius. No, he was just, you know, looking at a pie plate and acting towards that. So my take, look, for all the drama that this series had on the screen and off the screen, with D'Onofrio being exhausted, you know, and then bringing in rotating detectives every other episode, like we were divorced, going to different parents' houses.
Yeah.
This show ended the way it started in tone and in style and concept, and you can't say that about the other two big shows.
But I will say one thing.
What?
The fact that there was an actual mystery and case in this episode was fucking unnecessary. Like, it was. So they had this story. And I agree with you, Juwan. It's like they had this story that was just an episode story, right? It was just like someone steals someone's website. There's a mysterious murder. The final 5 minutes of this episode were so, to me, they were satisfying in terms of like conclusion stuff. I wanted to, as much as I enjoyed the first 40 minutes, I just wanted to like shove him under a bed. And I just, how lovely would it have been if, knowing this was the final episode, they just kind of stretched out the Goran angst, the Eames stuff, maybe had them investigating stuff, but only from their perspective?
Well, I think that they would say that was what the entire season was.
Yeah.
That 8 episodes. Because he went to therapy throughout the whole season where he's working out all of his shit.
Yeah.
You
it was
know,
like in treatment, but on the cheap.
Yeah. You know, and it's a way, I mean, if you want to get into any character's head that they've ever done, I mean, it would probably be this one.
I'm just glad they didn't bring back Nicole Wallace. I'm just going to be fucking
Oh, she's supposedly dead, but who knows, right?
So, I agree with you in the sense that it was definitely the same tone that it started with. And so that was the good thing about it. And so the other shows, they kept it consistent, but then it just kept going so long that you just have to have so many different things fall on and fall off. Versus where Criminal Intent, and I guess this is, as I've gotten older, I wasn't a Criminal Intent fan until at first. Not as big as I am now, but I really feel like it got a raw deal because of the D'Onofrio stuff. It's not as big as SVU stuff. Oh, it cost so much money for D'Onofrio the Fane, and now you have to bring in two other teams. Even though I like that concept of the two teams, it just was weird to just throw it in there.
So they had D'Onofrio, right?
Yeah.
Who, I mean, we know that he's method. We know that he's, but he's a big personality. He's a real actor. But they also, so when he like did his thing and they left, they brought in Chris Noth, who's also a big actor, and Annabella Sciorra, who's a huge actor.
Yeah. Jeff Goldblum, too.
Was in The Fly and Jurassic Park. Like, these are not, like, small potatoes actors.
No.
And the fact that it had to end with D'Onofrio and Irby tells you something about the fact that they are the heart of the show. They are the heart of the show. We did not watch this for anything other than those two. At least I didn't.
Absolutely. Well, look, we, as much as I like Robert Patrick, fuck him on the X-Files. I want Mulder and Scully, right? All right, let's take a look at the real-life story that inspired this episode. It's time for Ripped from the Headlines.
Who could it be?
You think you know who did it.
You think you know who did it.
But you don't know who did it.
You don't know who did it. Ripped from the Headlines.
Plot points from this episode come from the legal battle over the founding of Facebook. In 2002, identical twins Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss attempted to make a dating website for fellow Harvard students. After several programmers dropped out, the twins reached out to classmate Mark Zuckerberg. What happens next remains a huge point of contention. Zuckerberg launched thefacebook.com in 2004 as a social network for Ivy League students. The Winklevosses and their business partner, Divyan Narendra, threw a wobbly when they saw it. They claimed he'd stolen their idea, complained to the student newspaper and the university president, but could get no relief. They eventually sued Zuckerberg in federal court. Zuckerberg, in turn, sued the twins for a social networking site they eventually created. The parties settled a suit with the Winklevosses getting $20 million in cash and more than 1 million shares in Facebook stock. Today, Tyler and Cameron Winklevoss run a venture capital firm and have a combined net worth of $2 billion. Mark Zuckerberg's net worth is $104 billion, making him the fifth richest person in the world.
So the story is clearly represented in, you know, the social network, both the book and the movie. Certainly visually it takes a lot from that. Even having Justin Timberlake as the cool partying Napster douchebag.
Yes.
It wasn't completely clear in the movie, but Zuckerberg graduated from Phillips Exeter Academy Prep School.
Yep.
Just down the road from our friend Laura Bricker. At the prep school, they published a student photo directory, like a yearbook with students' names and phone numbers, and they called that the Facebook. So another New Hampshire contribution to the world. You're welcome.
Kevin, I'm sorry, but literally every college in America, the freshman incoming class, mine, SUNY Stony Brook in 1993, had an incoming thing called the Facebook.
Should we sue Zuckerberg too?
It is not. No. His name came from the analog version of it. Like, it was a smart name.
I think I just said that.
But it wasn't new. That being said, can we just talk about the fact that Armie Hammer aside and everything we know about him aside.
Fucking Jesus. I forgot about Armie.
I didn't fucking know that Armie Hammer wasn't two people when I first saw that movie. Just going to be honest with you. Also,
meantime, they had twins in the TV show and they only used one of them.
Yes. The Social Network, for everything we know about the real people and the real story about it, that movie by itself as a piece of art, almost a perfect 10. I fucking love that movie. Not going to lie. And that's why I'm so disappointed by like the 38-minute story that is basically a ripoff of that movie in this episode.
So to channel Julie Andrews, Juwan, how do you solve a problem like Facebook?
Oh, man. How much time do you have? Because I've I have had my
not ever enough.
But you know, I think what this one thing this episode captures is just how ridiculous the notion of these true internet heroes and stories were at the time. Like, they didn't give any leeway to like, oh, maybe they actually are telling a true story, or, you know, maybe this is, they're actually good people in the heart. They went straight for you. That was one of the things I loved about the writing of the later seasons. They were like, no, this is Law and Order. We see right through that. We're cynical about all that type of bullshit. And so they were very straightforward about how, like, their story, the love story of the characters in the show were, you know, was fabricated, and it's all just, you know, nonsense to sell the product. At the time, I don't think they saw it as like making a big hero out of Zuckerberg, but they wanted to believe that like this network in this movie and are these people that made this social network were like really the people of the future. And unfortunately, they were, but look at the future we're in.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure the Winklevosses dad is not disappointed in them at all. No. I'm sure he's very happy with where they are.
He has a nice oil portrait, I'm sure.
And they're alive.
Yeah.
So, you know, it works out.
There you go, Winklevi. Congratulations.
Hey, meantime, Mark Zuckerberg, and this is true, started the Mark Zuckerberg Book Club in 2015. Like Oprah, he had... Yeah, oh my God. Yeah, really. Like, his tastes were not... I mean, one of the books was Portfolio on the Poor, How the World Poor Live on $2 a Day.
Oh, Jesus fucking Christ.
Like, really, Zuckerberg, you're
Jesus
gonna...
Jesus okay. fucking Christ.
Oh, also, the book Why Nations Fail. I know. Social media.
Oh, my God.
There's that.
Election data.
Election data, yeah. Right now, there's plans to start an Instagram for kids.
Yay!
What could go wrong? SVU writers are already coming up with their rip from the headlines. Just waiting. That's going to do it for us. We want to thank our guest, Juwan Holmes. Juwan, where can our listeners follow you online?
Everyone can find me at Juwan, J-U-W-A-N, the curator, on almost all social media sites, and also Juwan the writer on Twitter as well.
And Rebecca Lavoie, the writer. How can our listeners follow you?
I am Reb Lavoie. It's mostly about dogs on Instagram, but it's also other stuff on Twitter. I am Reb Lavoie on all the platforms.
And you can track me on Twitter at Kevin P. Flynn. You can also tweet to us at Law & Order Pod or follow us on Instagram at These Are Their Stories Podcast. Our newsreader was Cy Frater. Our theme music was composed and performed by Uncanny Valleys. Line editing by Henry Lavoie. Content assistance from Travis Roy. Lily Flynn handles promotions. To get ad-free episodes of These Are Their Stories a week early, sign up for Stitcher Premium. All clips in this podcast were used in compliance with the U.S. Copyrights Act Fair Use Exemption for criticism and commentary. Special thanks to the elite squad of the Law & Order Wiki community for preserving the evidence. Go to lawandorderpodcast.com. Sign up for our newsletter for a chance to be our next Law & Order Marathon winner. These Other Stories was recorded in the Yoga Loft above the Bodega in Bay St. Louis, Mississippi studio, and is a production of Partners in Crime Media. Partners in Crime Media.